pension.
They came into the gilt market and set up an operation that was the right size of medium sized, I think was the phrase I used. They were taking on some quite big business, and they started it up from scratch, not by buying somebody else, and they bought in expertise, but they didn't buy a firm. And so the answer to your question, you know, was it possible to bridge the gap? I think it has to be yes. Though they didn't bridge it by buying a small firm, making it larger, they did it off their own bat. Some of the smaller firms did do some quite decent sized business at times, particularly on these tap stock mornings and so on. They would have a sizable allocation of stock from the government broker, and that put them in the way of not only simply selling that straight, but doing switch business and so on.
In retrospect, how did you feel about the decision to stop jobbing, particularly as the 1970s unfolded and the gilt market became a very lucrative one for the jobbers who had managed to stay in it?
Yes, well, I didn't find any opportunities to carry on jobbing in the gilt market, but I was offered the opportunity to job in the fixed interest market. And I thought quite hard about that, because it was quite a decent proposition that was made. But I just felt that my experience had been in the gilt market, and I knew all the people. I therefore felt that I'd rather stay in that, even though it was on the other side of the fence, rather than go and job elsewhere where I would have to make new contacts and so on. So that was what I did. Initially, I didn't enjoy it particularly because there's a great freedom in being a jobber. It's your own money. You can say what you like by way of price and so on, and in various other ways too, if you feel inclined. Whereas as a broker, you're somebody else's servant, and you're go between the client and the jobber, and that took a little getting used to.
Which firm did you go to?
I went to Laurie Milbank initially, and I was there for a couple of years, I possibly in no small part because it was the transition period. I didn't particularly enjoy it, though I made some good friends there. And so after 2 years, I moved to Penn, mm-hmm. and I stayed there until a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. when I packed up altogether.
How did these changes happen? Did you have friends in the firms?
The recruitment changes?
Yes.
Honestly, forget now. But what generally tends to happen, and I think it must have done, with the Laurie Milbank one, what generally tends to happen is that you find that one of the jobbers is in fact acting as a job broker, he would be aware of a broker wanting to take on somebody. And you have to remember that everybody knows everybody anyway, but unless you're actually unemployed, you're not likely to get a direct approach. But I think in where it was known that I was obviously known that I was looking for a job after the Bruce and Hinton thing, it may very well be that a number of the approaches were in fact direct. Mm-hmm. I would guess that there were some of both sorts, some direct and some, you know, somebody acting as a go-between. And when I left Laurie Milbank to go to I in fact answered an advertisement. It was one of these rather anonymous affairs in the Financial Times, which I followed up.
Did you feel? I'm sorry.
I didn't. In fact, I did not know that it was them when I replied to it. Mm-hmm. But latterly, once I was at Panmure Gordon, I think any recruiting that we did by the other method that I mentioned. That I would be talking to a friend in the market, say, looking for somebody who might do this or that. And generally, if it was particularly if it was somebody one knew really well, he could stand there and run through all the people who were looking around. And I would know them and would be in a position to say, well, I don't like him, I don't like him, but perhaps we ought to talk to him. And then something would be set up.
Can you describe what you did now when you joined these broking firms? Did you... you became a broker-dealer?
Yeah.
What?
Well, mostly it involved being in the market all the time and trying as best one could to know what all the prices were all the time. And talking back to the office by phone and latterly by radio and generally keeping in touch and obviously doing all the business that came along, actually dealing with the jobbers, and a certain amount of contact with clients, but more the market and dealing angle than the contact with clients one.
What was the reaction to you? Well, how did you find the reaction, perhaps from former friends who were still jobbers to your becoming a broker? Was there a certain amount of leg pulling or?
It was a certain amount of leg pulling, yes. And there was a great deal of leg pulling in the stock exchange because except on relatively rare occasions, one did spend a fair amount of time hanging around waiting for something to happen, as one does in all markets. And so there was a lot of joking and leg pulling going on. So yes, when you change, a fair amount of joking and fooling around, but. People were very helpful, basically. And there's certainly no antagonism or anything like this.
Did you feel your experience as a jobber gave you a particular advantage when you were going up to deal with them?
Yes, I think it did. Every now and again, perhaps to some extent, a leg-pulling spirit, you'd get people saying, "Now, come on, you've done this job, perfectly well. I'm not going to want to do that. Why are you even suggesting it?" That kind of thing. But by and large, I felt that it was very helpful to me to have been a jobber before being a broker. People were inclined to be helpful.
Did you, presumably now you had a greater deal of contact with the investors, either the institutions or the private clients. What I'm getting at there is, did you feel, having moved over the broking side of the stock exchange, that there was much understanding of what jobbers did, the kind of problems that they faced, and where they fitted into the market?
What, my understanding or the client's
understanding? The client's understanding.
I think... Yes, it helped. I didn't speak to clients an awful lot, and those that I did, I didn't speak to any private clients. That's a slight exaggeration, but I wouldn't speak to them during the normal cut and thrust of business. For instance, if one had a client, like it might be your solicitor or family clients or something like that. By and large, that would be fairly pedestrian sort of business, and nothing to do with what I'd been hired to do, which was the professional, ill-edged business. So that didn't really apply. And talking to the professional clients that I would talk to, they were indeed professional clients, so they knew what went on and didn't really need to be told. They would have a sufficient understanding of the jobbing system not to need much help from me.
Did you feel now, particularly after the shakeout around the early 70s, when, as you mentioned earlier, a couple of firms went out, that there was an adequate number of firms in the gilt market, or did you feel that created difficulties for brokers and that you really didn't have all that much to choose from?
Yeah, I think everybody, I think, all the brokers
welcomed the arrival in the market of Pynchon, for instance, because it was going to be another place to go if you've got a reasonable-sized business. But by and large, you got your business done all right. The other side of the coin, coming more up to date now, we obviously don't have very much experience, but this huge rush into the gilt-edged market on Big Bang, and there were, whatever there were, 28 market makers. If you stop and think about it for a moment, there's no way you can go to all 28 of them to find out what they're making. Perhaps it's there's room for you to, and bearing in mind that if you're doing the job properly, you will have a pretty good idea who to go to anyway. But I think that only extends to perhaps half a dozen or something like that places. Otherwise, I mean, you simply can't get round a huge number of different jobbers and or market makers. So that I think business got done pretty satisfactorily during the very busy years in the 80s. And there were log jams now and again, particularly on these tap stock mornings where the, you know, the jobbers had got a list and all this kind of thing. And that used to cause pretty good chaos, possibly for an hour or so, because they were concentrating their attention on what they were actually doing in this stock. You'd find it quite difficult to get prices in other stocks or to start thinking about what the switch possibilities were and this kind of thing. But I don't think that having a greater number of jobbers would have improved that. They'd all have the same problem. So that it all worked fairly satisfactorily. And the criticism of it, which it was receiving, criticism that it was not sufficiently competitive, I thought was a load of rubbish, because the competition amongst all the players in it, brokers against brokers and the market makers, the two big ones in particular, they competed pretty hard against one another. And my feeling was that the Bank of England thought it all worked fairly well too.
Did you feel personally, or did Panmure Gordon's firm feel, that single capacity was harming its business in any way? Particularly now, you know, one reads about the growth of the foreign banks in the city and the development of a market outside of the house.
Well, I don't think Panmure Gordon can possibly, though I can't speak for them, can possibly believe that, because they still operate in single capacity and they are agency brokers. While I was still there after Big Bang, they, I think, took positions occasionally, but only very occasionally. They certainly didn't go around making prices in anything, gilts, equities or anything else. And I think that they've been, through that policy, one of the success stories of Big Bang, and there aren't very many of those. Mm-hmm. I think they've, I would imagine, have remained profitable all the time. Mm-hmm. And having, I mean, the biggest factor in that was not going into market making.
Let me revert just for a few moments again to the pre-Big Bang period. You've mentioned Smith Brothers that tried to get into the gilt market and failed. Is there any particular reason why a firm like Smith Brothers would fail in the gilt market, perhaps from your experience as a jobber during the 60s or again as a broker with a knowledge of the market during the 70s?
Yes, I think they made two mistakes, I thought. One was that they bought a small jobber, and I think that they thought they were buying, and they were buying a back office and an account at the Bank of England, and that was all fine. They also thought that they were buying some gilt-edged market expertise. I say this with great respect for the people who were the partners of that firm, who I knew very well and liked.
But they were small private client size jobbers, basically. And that wasn't the sort of business that the Smith brothers wanted to do. So they did not, where they might have thought they were, they did not buy expertise in that particular field. They then put their own people into it, and they tried to job the gilt market the way they jobbed the equity market, and it simply didn't work. And I think that they tried to sort of job their way out of it, and things got bigger and bigger and worse and worse.
What was the difference between equity jobbing and gilt jobbing?
Well, it may not be that it's the difference between equity jobbing and gilt jobbing, but it's a question of the style of Smith Brothers to some extent. And I think that, again, I can't speak from experience, but I think that their method of jobbing in equities was keep turning it over and not, or try not to take big positions. And I think they tried to do that in gilts. And it was that didn't work, that in gilts by that time, you simply had to run big positions, possibly for quite a long time, and wait the opportunity to sort them out profitably. And they tried to undo them, and they just drove the market up and down. Needless to say, there would be people around to take advantage of a situation like that if it occurred.
What was the attitude among the gilt jobbers, or again, among the brokers specialising in gilts, to newer types of financial instrument, which began to appear during the 60s? I'm thinking of the Eurobond. Did they ever consider taking them up and trading them in a big way, or were they regarded as being something quite other and out of the normal range of
business? I think they were regarded in just that way. I mean, we certainly, while I was jobbing, we never contemplated dealing in Eurobonds. I mean, one reason that I mentioned before was capital. I mean, we had not enough capital to job in gilts. What were we thinking about jobbing in something else? So I think it just wasn't really considered.
Was that the attitude generally among jobbers?
Well, I think it was, yes, because also that Eurobonds did not trade in single capacity, did they?
No.
I think the people who got into Eurobonds were brokers who took positions, which they were permitted to do, and I can't remember now in what way they were permitted to do it, but they were. So whether it was in effect offered to the gilt market, if you like, or to the fixed interest market to look after these things, and they turned it down, or whether it was never offered or what, I don't remember. But I certainly do not remember ever considering it.
Well, that's probably the answer to the question, in the sense it didn't impinge to a great extent. Let me just ask you a few final questions about jobbing generally to wind things up. What did you think it took to be a successful jobber?
Well, you had to be able to make up your mind fairly quickly and be fairly decisive. And you were faced, every time somebody came on the pitch, with a situation, and you had to make a decision on it. And apart from that, I think various things that I didn't have would have been helpful, such as perhaps a better understanding of economics and perhaps also a better mathematical brain. Though I don't think a mathematical brain, in a sense, wasn't all that necessary. A quick reaction to events and decisiveness, I think, were things that you needed. I mean, one thing that people couldn't bear if they came and asked you a price was that you hummed and hawed and fiddled about and couldn't make up your mind. You had to say something, right or wrong. So I think that that's probably the a fairly key factor is.
What would you describe as the strengths of the jobbing system, if you felt there were any?
Well, there certainly were some, because they got huge amounts of business done fairly satisfactorily. And I think the complaints by the customers, i.e. the clients, about the single capacity system was more about fixed commissions, perhaps, than it was about the jobbers. They objected to the jobbers' profits, but what they were getting for those profits was a market in which they could always trade, a dedicated market maker market. Does have that advantage. There's always a guy there making prepared to make a price. It might not be the price you want to hear. It might not be in the size that you would like it to be in, but at least you can do something. And with markets that don't operate in that way, that isn't always the case. I think that a lot of the clients would say that they'd objected to the size of the brokers' commissions, which they most certainly did. They objected to the amount of money that the jobbers were making, but that was a touch of envy. And if they put their respective hands on their hearts, they would admit that they were getting a good service from the jobbers, in that there was always a price.
Would you say the jobbing system had any weaknesses?
Yeah, it was undercapitalised. Apart from that, I don't think that it necessarily had weaknesses.
Would you say that more as a having had experience of a smaller firm rather than a bigger one?
What, as a jobber?
Yes.
Don't know, really. How to answer that? I mean, it was... Shortage of capital was its weakness as far as I was concerned, because it's why I stopped jobbing when I did. I don't know how from within the people in the better capitalized, bigger firms felt about the jobbing system. I mean, presumably they thought it did a reasonably good job, and it certainly was a moneymaker for them. But I just think I wasn't thinking so much of that when I made my remarks, as the system. Mm. I mean, did it get done what people wanted it to do? And I thought the answer was that it did, with complaints from the clients that too much money was being creamed for the service that they were getting. But as I said before, I felt that their criticism was directed more at brokers' commissions than it was at what was happening in the market itself. And if they felt that they didn't like the jobbing system because basically it was two big players who were doing most of the business over a long period of time, but particularly latterly, and if they thought that everything was absolutely marvellous after Big Bang, it would appear that it's only going to be a fairly short space of time before we're back to a very small number of big players. Indeed, we've possibly even got that now. I'm not close enough to it to know. But I would think that there are probably quite a number of people who are gilt-edged market makers to whom many people simply wouldn't bother to go because they wouldn't hear something that was going to be to their liking. So I would think it's sort of polarised down to a very small number of big players. And the two old big players are probably the biggest and best of them right now.
Well, I think we can end on that note.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Fine.